This podcast features criminologists discussing sensitive themes and topics. Listener discretion is advised.
After nearly 20 years of addiction and cycles of incarceration, this woman became a leading voice for formerly incarcerated females. This is the Susan Burton story. Megan.
Morning.
Good to see you today.
Always.
Yes. I have to tell you, and I think you feel the same way, but I'm really loving the stories that we are covering for Women's History Month. And I cannot wait to do this again next year. In fact, I already have some cases lined up.
I know. We actually have covered a lot of inspiring women, but I think it's just in that mode, knowing that these were the cases I selected for this month. And yeah, I couldn't stop writing and I loved it. I was really, really inspired.
And our listeners and viewers, if you have any suggestions on women who have changed history or have had a major impact on the criminal justice system, let us know. As always, you can go to our website and click on Suggest a Case, or as many of you do, you can reach out on any of our social media channels. I'm very excited to introduce today's subject because I just finished her memoir this morning, Megan, and it was a powerful one.
There's a memoir, of course.
There is, but usually I finish way ahead, but I didn't finish till just this morning. But I wrote this story without the memoir. The memoir was just for some additional information, but we'll get more into the memoir at the end. But for now, let's meet Susan. Susan Burton was born the middle child and only girl to a large family in the early 1950s. In her early childhood, Susan lived with her parents and her five brothers. She had two older brothers and three younger brothers. The family resided in the housing projects in Los Angeles. Now, though both of her parents worked, the family really struggled financially. Her father was a World War II veteran and worked in a sheet metal factory, and her mother had graduated from Howard University with a major in home economics, which I found out, Megan, was one of the few options available to women at the time.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. I think it's incredible that in that time that she even went to college and she was working. In fact, she cleaned homes for a living when she wasn't caring for her children. And she had a big family, so it's incredible that she even found the time to work.
Right.
Susan's parents tried their best and by all accounts provided a really loving home for their children. But sadly, they were not able to keep Susan safe from a terrible fate at a young age. At just 4 years old, Susan was sexually assaulted by her aunt's boyfriend. And when her aunt found out, instead of going to the authorities and helping protect the child from future harm, she called Susan a, quote, dirty little girl and told her not to tell anyone what happened to her.
How did her family respond to that? Like her parents?
I'm not sure that her parents knew at this time. It was only her aunt who knew.
Okay.
And unfortunately, that wasn't where terrible things stopped for Susan either. Just 3 years later, when she was about 7 years old, her father lost his job at the sheet metal factory that he was working at. And this was during the wave of deindustrialization. And since industry was all he knew, he had trouble, like many people at the time, finding steady, gainful employment.
Yeah, this was a particularly hard time for blue-collar Americans.
Particularly minority blue-collar Americans as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
And Susan was very close to her father, and quite frankly, she adored him. But she would later say that after the layoffs, he was never the same. For one, he was no longer the happy-go-lucky man he had always been. And he also began leaving the family to go out by himself often. And he would go out till late hours in the night, early morning hours, and he would come home drunk. And on many occasions, Susan's parents would get into extremely violent arguments. And these began to escalate. And Susan later said that her mother would often have a black eye or a swollen lip after these altercations.
Oh, no.
Things were also physical between her father and her brothers at this time. And while Susan says her father was never abusive towards her, her mother and her brothers began to resent her for escaping her father's wrath, and she often faced verbal and physical abuse from the other members of the family.
Wow, this is really quite a decline.
Yeah, and it just gets worse, unfortunately, because, you know, by the time Susan's 10 years old, her parents split up and she lost most interactions with her dad. Remember, she adored her dad and she was very close to him. Right. But he got a job as a chef on an Amtrak train, so he would move to the East Coast and she wouldn't see him very often. In fact, they would go years without seeing each other. He still kept in touch, though. He would send gifts, he would write, he would call, but not seeing her father must have been extremely hard for young Susan.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. I hope he was, you said he sent gifts. I hope he was also financially supporting them with his income.
That I'm not sure of.
Okay.
After the divorce, Susan's mother started seeing a new man who would move them to a nice neighborhood, into a nice home. And in fact, he had a lot of money and he took care of the family financially. But after some time, they ended up moving to what she would explain as a rough neighborhood. Now, I'm not sure if the boyfriend ran out of money or if the two broke up at this time. But regardless, the home was extremely run down and it was infested with rats.
Oh, wow.
Also, remember Susan's aunt, the same one who told her to hide her sexual assault as a toddler?
Yeah.
She moved in with the family, and because the house was so small, Susan had to share her twin-size bed with this woman.
That's awful.
And in her memoir, Susan explains that she felt an anger brewing deep inside of her, and at this point, she would start avoiding being home as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And we know that for a lot of children, avoiding being home means that they are hanging out with people that maybe are not the best influences on them.
Right.
And not surprisingly, Susan's grade dropped at school and she started hanging around with people who were not good role models for her. And Susan's mother noticed that Susan was being more isolated, and so she tried to help her. At first, she sent her to what was called charm school. Have you heard of charm school?
I absolutely have.
You have? Okay. I actually didn't.
Sure.
I knew there's a reality show called Charm School, I think at one point on MTV. But other than that, I wasn't that familiar with it.
Yeah, no, it's real. It's how to make a lady, becoming a lady, manners mm-hmm. and other things. Yes.
And from what I understand, it was also known as finishing school, and it was popular in the 19th and early 20th century. And in fact, I read that it's a place that young women, usually from society families, that's where they would go. Their families would send them there to prepare them for marriage and help, yes. as you said, help refine young ladies so that they could interact well with others and manage a home with grace.
Exactly.
Yes. But more commonly, at the time we are discussing, it was just simply a school in which social graces were taught. Mm-hmm. And actually, I was curious if these still existed. Mm-hmm. And there are still some schools out there, but they're now called etiquette schools.
Ah, okay.
Mm-hmm. Susan's mother also made her become a brownie. Were you ever a brownie?
I was a brownie, yes. I mean, it was a short time, yes. but yes, I was.
Yes, I was a brownie as well. That's a young Girl Scout. Basically, they teach you life skills. You build community. It's clear that her mother was trying to do what she could to get her daughter help, to get her, you know, connected to pro-social activities. But unfortunately, things were only getting worse. As while Susan was selling cookies door to door for the brownies, she met an elderly neighbor. Now, this neighbor at first just seemed like a nice guy. He started giving her money, buying her things, buying the family nice things. And he was giving Susan a lot of, I guess you could say, unwanted attention. Mm. This is a classic case of grooming, right?
This, I was going to say that. And how old is Susan at this time? Do we know? At least, I mean, she was over 10.
She was over 10, but she was about 11 or 12 at this point.
Okay.
And this man's attention turned violent. He habitually raped Susan and would then give her money for her, quote, troubles. And this would happen for over a 2-year period. And the only reason that it stopped was because the man ended up dying of a heart attack. But the harm was already done to Susan.
A lot of harm.
And on top of all this that Susan was dealing with, she was suspended from school for wearing a skirt that was too short. Now, I say, why not just send the child home to change? And we don't know. We weren't there. Perhaps she had been warned in the past. Or maybe they were just looking for reasons to suspend the young girl. But who really knows? But suspending a child is only going to make things worse. And in fact, it pushed Susan further away from pro-social connections.
Okay.
Since Susan's mother worked during the day, while she was suspended, there was no one at home to make sure that Susan was keeping up with her studies. And Susan spent all of her days hanging out on the street with peers who didn't attend school or older people as well. Mm-hmm. And after she was allowed back in school, she was so far behind at this point, she probably experienced so much frustration and she just gave up and stopped going to school altogether.
Terrible.
So she wasn't going to school, but she also didn't want to be at home. So she would run away from her family for days at a time. And it's likely she was just with friends that she made on the street.
Jeez, this must have been a pretty long school suspension. I mean,
it wasn't a long school suspension, but she didn't go back even when she was allowed to because she was already so far gone. She explains
it's just like the straw that broke the camel's back.
Exactly.
Kind of.
She explains it that she went back. She tried going back and she was so lost in her studies that it was just too much to handle.
Right.
That's another reason why, you know, suspension is not always the best means because it sometimes just makes things worse for a child. Again, Susan's mother recognized that things were not going well for Susan, and this time she sent Susan to juvenile hall. And I'm not sure if there were any offenses at this time other than Susan running away, but remember, she's a minor at this time.
Yeah, those are status offenses. Yes. So, I mean, it's not a great option to use juvenile punishment for status offenses like truancy mm-hmm. and curfews, but it is an option.
Yeah, and I feel for her mother. She was a yeah. single mother. She had, I think I said five or six children. That's a lot. It's a lot to handle. And one of her children is having trouble, right?
Right.
So she went to juvenile hall for a short time, and then she was released back to her mother when a judge ruled that she should be returned home. Okay. But she was under some form of supervision. Mm-hmm. Susan was personally struggling, and it didn't help either, Megan, that her community was a hostile environment. You see, in 1965, what became known as the Watts Riot broke out in Susan's neighborhood. Now, this would be adding an environmental risk factor to Susan, who's already having so many issues on a personal level. Just a quick note about the riots. Megan, are you aware of these riots?
Oh, absolutely. I teach this in my courses. Okay. Yes.
So very briefly, on August 11th, 1965, Marquette Fry, a 21-year-old African-American man, was pulled over for drunk driving. He failed his field sobriety test, and officers then attempted to arrest him, but he resisted arrest. And next, a physical confrontation ensued. During this confrontation, Marquette was struck in the face with a baton by a police officer. And by this point, there was a large crowd of people who have gathered to bear witness to this altercation. And then rumors spread that not only had the police hit the young man, they had also kicked a pregnant woman who was present at the scene.
Right.
This led to 6 days of civil unrest, mostly motivated by the allegations of police abuse. And this became massive as nearly 14,000 members of the California Army National Guard were called in to help. And the riot led to 34 deaths and over $40 million in property damages. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was known as the area's worst unrest until the riots of 1992 after the infamous Rodney King footage emerged.
It's also featured in the film Crips and Bloods, Made in America.
Yes.
Just so you know, that's a great film that shows the history as well of the riots and other race conditions that led to the riots and civil unrest and really the frustration and the mistreatment of Black America. Mm-hmm. So that's also one of the ways I know about it and teach about it.
I, too, have my students watch that documentary, and then I have them explain one character's actions using relevant criminological theories. I'm assuming I got that from you, huh?
I think you did. I usually have them. There's a lot of significant quotes in that film that relate to criminological theory. Mm-hmm. So I usually have them take some of the quotes and relate that mm-hmm. to the theory.
Yep.
So I'm sure we shared this.
Yes. Civil unrest can be a huge stressor for people who are already struggling with these personal risk factors like Susan was. So this was not a good place to be while Susan was already experiencing so much personal trauma. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. things would only continue to escalate for Susan. As when she was 14, she went to a party with a friend, and both girls were sexually assaulted by a group of older boys. Now, at this time, Susan was back in school, which is good. But after experiencing this sexual assault, one of her teachers noticed that she looked a little bit different. Now, the teacher pulled her aside and suggested she take a pregnancy test. And that's how. And that's when she found out that she was pregnant, again, at just 14 years old, and the pregnancy was a result of a sexual assault.
And I mean, at this point, she's been victimized sexually so many times, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Yeah. And her mother was very angry. And while abortion could have been an option for her, Susan's pregnancy was too far along, so she would have to go through and give birth to the child.
Okay.
Something else I learned in this episode, she was sent to live in a facility that was quite common at the time. Mm-hmm. There were facilities for teenage unwed pregnant girls, and they would give birth to children there and then often give the child up for adoption.
Right, yeah.
You've heard of these before? They were popular yes. in the 50s and 60s, and they were referred to as maternity homes, apparently.
That's correct, yes. And it was how a lot of families, especially who, unfortunately at the time, looked at it as being shameful,
yes.
Dealt with their teenage daughters' pregnancies.
Yeah, it was actually one of the primary goals of these facilities was to protect mothers from the stigma of unplanned pregnancy or adoption. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of mm-hmm. like a safe place for women to carry out their pregnancies and put the babies up for adoption in secret.
In secret being kind of the key.
Exactly. Yes. Susan gave birth to a baby girl. In fact, the day before she turned 15, she gave birth. She named the baby Antoinette. She would call her Tony. And remember, I said it was common for girls in her situation to give up the baby for adoption at the facility, yeah. but she decided she wanted to keep the child. So she went.
And her family, her mother was okay with this?
Well, her mother ended up caring for Tony because unfortunately, Susan returned to the streets very soon after having the child.
Okay.
And while on the streets, Susan met a man named James. James was a pimp, and for 5 years, he sold Susan to other men, and he was also physically abusive towards her. But Megan, she was making a lot of money working for James, and she stayed, and she was looking forward to the day that she turned 18 because her mother was threatening her with sending her to juvenile hall again. And, mm-hmm. you know, her and her mom had a very strained relationship at this time. They could barely tolerate each other because, of course, Susan's mother was caring for her grandbaby.
Right.
While, you know, Susan was still on the streets. But before she could escape and press out on her own, Susan was arrested for prostitution. This would start a long string of jail and prison stays.
Sure.
And, you know, there was a brief time I want to point out, a brief time when Susan was doing better. And during this brief time, she had a second child in 1976, whom she named KK. Now, for this short time, the family was happy. Tony and Susan were back together, the family was close, and they all doted on this little boy. But at just 5 years old, KK was tragically struck and killed while crossing the street.
Oh, God.
By a police car, no less.
Oh, that's terrible.
As you could imagine, Susan went into a deep depression after this and turned back to drugs. And as a result of turning back to drugs and turning back to the street, her relationship with Tony again began to deteriorate, and Tony went back to live with Susan's mother.
Okay.
And things would only get worse for Susan when she met a man who introduced her to crack cocaine.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, they were coming about, probably coming quickly on the 80s there, yep. or in the 80s.
Absolutely.
So,
and not only was she now using herself, but she became a dealer. She would be in and out of prison many times between the 80s and the 90s because of her dealing and her using.
Okay.
And like thousands of other people, every time mm-hmm. she was released, she was let back into society with barely any cash, no ID, mm-hmm. no social security card, and essentially no way to try to put her life on a better path.
And back to the same neighborhood, the same influences.
Yes, exactly.
So, you know, what's the expectation here?
Yeah, she was trapped in the vicious cycle that so many people leaving prison find themselves in. Mm-hmm. And each time Susan was released, she explains being left at a bus stop, no housing prospects, no ability to get a job, and also with no mental health or addiction treatment. You know, what do we expect to happen in this situation?
This was also commonplace practice, too, like across the country, especially in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s. There were some major civil suits about the way in which the Department of Corrections was simply dropping off mm-hmm. in secrecy people with absolutely nothing at a bus stop. Especially, it was a common practice among those who were mentally ill mm-hmm. as well, left with no resources. Mm-hmm. So this wasn't uncommon at the time, and it did come to light, I would say, in a number of civil suits that I've covered in some of my policy courses in the 1990s and early 2000s.
And in her book, Susan explains what it was like getting off of that bus. You know, she's physically frail, mentally frail. She's an addict, and it was almost like people would come to the bus stop looking for their next victim. So it wasn't long before someone would be offering her a job to sell her body or giving her drugs.
Right.
As a means of survival, Susan would simply return to the streets, resume her drug dealing and drug using exactly where she left off, which would then lead to another arrest, another jail sentence, and then they would release her back at the bus stop, start the cycle all over again.
There's nothing to break the cycle.
Well, luckily for Susan, in 1997, she found the Claire Foundation in Santa Monica. This was an organization that would help her get clean once and for all. Now, the organization today is known as Claire Matrix because in 2018, the Claire organization joined forces with an institute called the Matrix Institute on Addiction Services. Now, the organization today offers substance abuse and mental health treatment, residential housing, training, and research. If you're interested, check out their website at claremetrix.org. But I'll tell you, Susan credits the Claire Foundation for saving her life.
Mm-hmm.
However, even after getting clean, Susan still struggled to make ends meet. She had issues with housing and employment, as many people do after incarceration. She was having issues getting food stamps due to her criminal record and felony drug mm-hmm. charges. But luckily, her daughter, Tony, She had been repairing her relationship with her, and Tony let Susan stay with her. And Tony now had a daughter, so Susan had a granddaughter who was around 11 years old at this time.
Wow, okay. Yeah,
and this was really nice of Tony to do because, you know, she definitely had some resentment towards her mother for all that she went through as a young girl. But this was very helpful because Susan had a roof over her head.
Just going to point out, from what we know also, familial bonds and support are one of the strongest measures of success for prisoner reentry.
And while having a roof over her head was helpful, she still struggled to get back on her feet. One major setback occurred after she found a job working as a home health aide. She loved this job. She worked with a woman who was very elderly and ill, and she said it felt good to give back. She felt like she was really doing a service to others. Mm-hmm. So she wanted to get certified to continue along this career path. However, when she went to look into it, she was told that she could not be a certified home health aide given her background. So unfortunately, it was time for Susan to pivot and figure out something else to do.
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't believe how many professions people are precluded from because of their record. It doesn't make sense.
Even worse, a lot of prisons will train people in vocations that bar them from entering into it when they get out. So there's a huge disconnect there.
I know.
But rather than falling back into old habits, Susan's struggles led her to activism. She decided that she wanted to help women who were in a similar situation to herself. In 1998, Susan was able to buy a house along with two other individuals, and instead of just using it for herself, she converted it into a home for recently released female offenders.
And wow. oh my goodness.
This is only the start of the work Susan does. I'll tell you that not only did she buy this home and open it to women who needed a place to stay, she gave up her comfort for others. Megan, she set up a cot in the dining room as her room so other women could have an actual bedroom. Now, these three individuals scratched together the little that they had, and they got a few early modest donations, but they were able to make the home a comfortable living space. Susan would go to the bus station, you know, that bus station where she was released so many times before.
Yes.
And she would find women who were released, a lot of them she knew from when she was in the system,
right.
And she would invite them to come stay with her.
That's incredible. So instead of these women being preyed upon, mm-hmm. there's someone who's coming there to actually offer them help. What a nice change or turn of events.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I've heard some interviews with women who were taken in by Susan and her organization, and they talk about how, you know, it's almost like at first you don't believe that someone has good intentions because you're so right. used to people preying upon you.
Right.
Susan would also go back into prison to advertise her services to women who would soon be getting out. And in the first few months, she had 10 women living in the house, and the work was very rewarding to Susan. But after a year, she began to lose money, and she did not have enough money to support everyone. In fact, you know, she was helping too much that she was now
right.
just, she couldn't do it anymore. But luckily, right. a friend helped her apply for a grant, and this grant would help her form her home into a real nonprofit organization.
Wow.
And as a result, a New Way of Life reentry project was officially born.
Oh, I just got chills.
This organization offered, and still does, quote, empathy through experience by empowering and building the leadership skills of formerly incarcerated people. They also hire formerly incarcerated people, and they provide cutting-edge organizational leadership that promotes resources for disenfranchised people living in marginalized communities.
So, Amy, does this extend? This is for women primarily?
It's just for women, yes.
Just for women. Okay,
yes.
Great.
Susan would also go on to become a certified chemical dependency counselor.
Ah.
And Megan, Susan didn't stop at just one reentry house. As of 2023, A New Way of Life had 10 houses, each with an average of 7 residents.
Wow, that's really incredible.
And these aren't just any houses. These houses are designed to be intimate and have a home feeling. The home has yeah. matching bedspreads and curtains, inspirational post-it messages like behind a mirror in the bathroom, it says, always wear an invisible crown. It was very.
I do. Yeah. No, I'm kidding. Sorry.
The New York Times did a piece on Susan and her homes, and they took a lot of pictures of the inside of the homes. And you could see like the amount of care that went into making these women feel like they finally have a welcoming place to lay their head at night.
What a comfort that must be after not having anywhere or being in prison mm-hmm. to come to a warm, safe, comfortable home. Yep.
Susan has said that on the many times that she stepped off that Greyhound bus in downtown L.A. after incarceration, she wished she had a place to go with a, quote, atmosphere that's bright, cheerful, and motivating that says you are worthy. So this is how she's built a new way of life. She says lots of natural light and artwork on the wall is very important.
Oh, I agree. I agree.
Oh, and 100%. Actually, I didn't even mention some of these women have their children living with them there as well. So it's a safe haven for children. And a lot of women lose their children and they don't get them back because they don't have a permanent residence.
Right.
And a new way of life allows women to get their children back because the children have a safe place to go.
Fantastic. Wonderful, wonderful all around.
And she has a whole team of people now. They have people she has people dedicated to housing, legal services, workforce and education development, and advocacy.
So basically, she has someone working in all the areas that have proven to be successful for reentry.
Yes, brilliant. And she's been extremely successful. Listen to this, and I just got the chills again, even though I've read this 100 times. Or even, yeah, I've read these stats so many times, and they still get me. So currently, as of the end of 2023, they've provided housing to over 1,500 formerly incarcerated women. They have helped reunite more than 400 women and children, and they have provided pro bono legal services to more than 3,400 community members with conviction histories.
Those numbers are staggering. She's really accomplished. She and her team have really accomplished something, nothing short of miraculous.
Yeah, and they report a 90% success rate of reentry, which I'm not surprised because they really offer the whole package. And Susan has said, of course, not every single person is successful. But when people are not successful, she matches them to a treatment facility that can provide the necessary help they need.
That makes sense. I was going to ask you about their recidivism rates or success rates. And 90% is certainly it's a high, high number.
Yeah, because the national averages are around 70% of people within the first 3 years of release will end up back in the system in some way.
I know. I think my students still find that number shocking, actually, when I tell them.
This incredible woman has also become a nationally known advocate for restoring basic and human rights to those who have served time. And she has earned many accolades for her work. I'm just going to name a few.
Okay.
Susan was a 2010 recipient of the Gleitzman Citizen Activist Award from the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard Kennedy School. Then in 2015, on the 50th anniversary of Selma to Montgomery marches and the signing of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Los Angeles Times named Susan one of the 18 new civil rights leaders in the nation. Some of her other honors include being named a Starbucks Upstander, a CNN Top 10 Hero, a Soros Justice Fellow, a Women's Policy Institute Fellow at the California Women's Foundation, and a Violence Prevention Fellow with the California Wellness Foundation. And that's not all, Megan. She is also an author. Okay. She is also an author. Her memoir, which was released in 2017, called Becoming Miss Burton, received a 2018 NAACP Image Award for outstanding literary work in the category of biographies. She also has won several other book prizes for the book. Susan also holds an honorary Doctor of Humane Letters from California State University, Northridge.
Well, there's no stopping her.
There's not. And luckily, her good deeds do not go unnoticed because in 2020, Governor Gavin Newsom granted her a pardon for her work in helping women put their lives back together after incarceration.
That's great. She deserves it.
And lastly, as far as her accolades go, at least for now, in 2023, she was named an honoree of NBC News Inspiring America, the Inspiration List. This is a list that recognizes 10 honorees annually for their efforts to help others. And she's in good company with LeBron James and Jane Goodall and some others.
Or they're in good company.
Susan Burton. Susan Burton.
I was like going to say, guess what? I don't know. She wants to hang out with us.
Susan Burton herself was a guest on Armchair Expert a couple of years ago. And that's how I initially heard of her story.
That makes perfect sense because anyone who listens will know that you are devout.
I am. I am smitten with that podcast. But anyway, so if you want to hear her speak, I would say go check out Armchair Expert's interview with her. It was really well done.
Read her memoir, too, if you want to learn more about her.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I want to spend a little time talking about women in our criminal justice system. Now, Megan, I know that you teach women in crime, so this is an area you're very well versed in, and probably a lot of our listeners and viewers are as well from listening to us. But let's talk a little bit about the fact that although there are many more men than women in prison, the rate of growth for female imprisonment is extreme. Oh. In fact, the rate of growth has been twice as high as that of men since 1980. And according to the Sentencing Project, it's estimated that the incarceration rate for women in the U.S. grew more than 8 times between 1980 and 2019, going from, get this, 26,000 to 222,000.
Right.
Megan, we are talking about an increase of 700%.
Yeah, this was primarily due to the war on drugs and the new laws that treated women who had very low-level roles, if any, as equal accomplices to their male counterparts for drug crimes.
I was surprised to learn, though, I didn't know the exact numbers, but there are almost 1 million women currently under supervision of the criminal justice system.
And is it 1 million? Okay. I don't think I knew the number was that high.
It's about 976,000 to be exact.
Okay. Yeah.
And this isn't just affecting women, because over half of women who are imprisoned have a child under the age of 18. Now, this is creating issues for family members and communities as a whole. So the over-incarceration of women is not, you know, a simple concept.
No.
And as you mentioned, there are many ways that we can understand this. I think one of the major reasons we have seen such an increase has been the expansive law enforcement efforts around, you know, stiffer drug sentencing laws. Mm-hmm. But I also think that post-conviction barriers to reentry are also a big issue. Women have unique needs when reentering society because women are incarcerated for different crimes than men. Now, when we look at the state prison, women are more likely than men to be incarcerated for a drug or property crime, and less likely to be incarcerated for a violent offense. The problem is, Megan, these jails and prisons have historically been designed exclusively for men. So any programming or support that we have in prison that will help people for the reentry stage are simply not geared towards women.
Right. Women also have histories that include a much higher rate of sexual abuse, addiction, even though male addiction is high as well. Mm-hmm. Mental health issues. And so when I teach about this in my class, one of the things I focus on is gender responsive programming. Mm-hmm. There was a large shift or a movement to find equal treatment for women, that give them the same programming that men were given. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, that was a step forward. But in others, as we progress, we know that they don't need exactly the same. They need something that responds to their unique needs.
You're right. And just to put some numbers behind what you're saying, 86% of women in jail have experienced sexual violence, and 77% have experienced intimate partner violence. So unfortunately, you know, jails and prisons do little to address these unique needs. So we can't expect women to be able to move past their trauma if we're not acknowledging the trauma.
Correct.
Other than the issues that we talked about, incarcerated women also have high rates of chronic health issues. And I'm talking mental health and physical health and substance abuse needs as well. Mm-hmm. And while incarcerated, women are more likely to experience serious psychological distress. However, they are less likely to have access to treatment programs. So as you mentioned, they're the ones who need these programs and they're the ones who have less access. And upon reentry, things for women don't get any easier. 80% of women in jail are mothers, and most of them are single parents. So with few support services available to them, when women are released, they face great challenges finding work and housing and also trying to get their children back. Now, with all this said, Megan, I mean, there are so many theories that can help us understand how Susan ended up in the criminal justice system time and time again. In her case, I think we see a lot of cumulative disadvantage. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. Almost like a perfect storm.
It is, because Susan, you know, while she had a loving home for a part of her childhood, starting from that sexual assault at a very young age, that kind of started the ball rolling with trauma and abuse that Susan would face. And, you know, every time she tried to get up, she would just get beaten back down. Like finally was trying to go to school, then got suspended for, you know, what she was wearing. And it seems like, and then she tried to go back to school again, and then she got sexually assaulted. So she was trying, but unfortunately, like time and time again, she would have these, you know, negative stimuli that would just come in and push her back down.
Absolutely. Cyclical violence, trauma, disadvantage, snowballs.
Also, there was social disorganization, talking about like just what was going on in her community at this time as well. So it really does seem like the perfect storm of internal and external risk factors that led to Susan being where she was. And in fact, the fact that she turned to activism instead of turning back to the streets is really nothing short of miraculous, given what she was up against.
I agree. I also think that we didn't discuss labeling theory, just so you know, because Susan was, she suffered all these disadvantages, but then was arrested. She'd be released. She's labeled also at times where she was released and she's trying to do pro-social things with her life, like get jobs. She's labeled a felon, mm-hmm. so she can't then get access to pro-social work and opportunities. So I think the stigma of it as well puts people in a cycle that's very hard to escape and that she so successfully did.
Yeah. And this brings up the question of, you know, why do some people turn to activism while others resort back to crime? And I think for Susan, obviously there must be something within her biologically that enabled her to finally get out of this cycle. But I think having, you mentioned it earlier, having that family support is so mm-hmm. invaluable. Because she had not only a roof over her head, which we know leads to greater outcomes, but she had people in the community. And her daughter was brilliant and going to school and had a career. So she had people who were positive influences in the community that were willing to help her.
Right. There's a number of reasons that explain why someone chooses activism and survival and, you know, why someone might choose that path of saving their lives. Other people maybe can't see the path. Other people are disadvantaged. They don't have any support system whatsoever. So yeah, it could be something just as small as meeting the right person. Yeah. It could be something as small as walking into an AA or NA meeting. There are small things and large things that can really steer the course, change the course of someone's life.
Yeah, recall she said that Claire Foundation or the Claire mm-hmm. organization really changed her life. So the fact that she right. was able to have her family and then she was able to connect with this organization mm-hmm. that was able to help right. her with her addiction once and for all, that's really what changed yes. for Susan.
Yep.
And the system has been changed for the better because of people like Susan. And we Agreed. Tend to talk a lot about how the system is broken and what needs to be done. But I think it's nice to finally showcase how the system could be fixed and where things yeah. are actually working and changing for the better.
Right.
And, you know, while we talk about this, I can't help but bring up my experience working in the prisons, working with NJ Step and the students there, because many of the students who are released from incarceration after going through the program, they're starting their own organizations. They're supporting each other. You know, in New Jersey, they have Meet Them at the Gate, where a group of Yes. individuals, every time someone's coming home, they meet them. And they cheer them on and they bring them to like the local bodega to get, you know, their first free cup of coffee and something to
eat. I love it.
And it's just a way to tell people like, we are here for you and we're going to help mm-hmm. you. It's incredible.
Absolutely.
For anyone who's interested in learning more about, you know, women incarceration, women reentry, you can, of course, check out A New Way of Life, Susan's organization. There's also an organization called The Wire, which stands for Women Involved in Reentry Efforts. And this is a network of formerly incarcerated women who have successfully reintegrated back into the community after their release. And basically what these women have done is they've joined together to provide peer support and peer advocacy to women both in prison and women who are coming home from incarceration. So you should check them out if you're interested in donating or just learning more. They're at thewiredc.org. There are also a lot of local organizations that provide services for women after incarceration. For one, we talked about the Claire Matrix, which operates in parts of mm-hmm. California and Ontario. Megan, we're very well aware of the Fortune Society, which operates out of New yes. York. And there's many, many others. So if you are interested, you know, check it out, volunteer your time, you know, get to know these women in these organizations. They're doing really incredible things.
Sure are.
Isn't it nice to have an episode that ends like on a happy note? I mean, we always try to wrap it on a happy note, but I feel so good after this episode, don't you?
I do too. We can't always end. We don't no. always wrap on a happy note. We try to find a silver lining, but today's was truly inspiring. I wish Susan and her organization the best of luck. It's so wonderful to hear about someone like her who has gone out of her way to, you know, heal herself and then help all of these other women. Such a role model, such an inspiration. And yeah, there, like you said, there are so many organizations that are doing the same. So yeah. It's great to end on this positive, forward-looking yes. path.
And while I did cover a lot and a lot of the work that Susan has done and some of these other organizations, I urge you to read her memoir because there is so much more. We just simply didn't have the time to go through everything that she has done. But we really are scratching the surface here because there's a lot of good stuff going on.
Thank you, Amy. It was a great episode. I'm sure the listeners and the viewers will appreciate today's episode as much as I did.
Yes. Well, thank you all for being here. And I look forward to covering more of these types of cases. And we hope to catch you next time on Women in Crime.
Women in Crime is written and hosted by Megan Sachs and Amy Schlossberg. Our producer is James Varga. Script editing is by Abigail Belcastro. Audio editing is by Siler Burr and Jose Alfonso. And music is by Desert Media. If you enjoy the show, please remember to follow and leave a review. You can also support the show through Patreon, where you can get access to additional ad-free content such as exclusive full-length episodes, lectures, a book club, and virtual happy hours with Megan and Amy. For more information, visit patreon.com/womenandcrime.
Sources for today's episode include Becoming Miss Burton, beingsusanburton.com, ABC7, CNN, The New Press, The New York Times, the Vera Institute of Justice, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the LA Times, the Research and Education Institute, King's Institute.stanford.edu, and The Today Show.